Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Eaton. Joining us as he does every Thursday for Open Mic is Alec Beam. Alec. We call him Alex, too. And as Marjorie, we don't know him that well. And as Marjorie and I do every time he's here, we marvel at how appropriate it is that he's named Alex. Because Marjorie said this morning, when Alex writes a column, it's like Sir Alex Ferguson on the soccer field. He always scores that winning goal. Remember when you said that, Marjorie? Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe, even though he said in the New York Times column a week ago that he didn't work for the Globe. We'll get to that in a minute. I don't quite get it.
Yeah,
his new book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Hello there, Alex.
Hi,
Jim,
Alex.
Marjorie, it's great to be here.
It's
how do you do?
Always great to be here. So you have many obsessions, I suspect, Alex. But we're going to start with a couple of them. It seems like you have a big thing, a semi-obsession with David Baron. He's a Harvard law professor. His nomination to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit is sort of hanging in the balance down in Washington, D.C. because of some drone strikes. Now, what is going on with you and Mr. Baron or Professor Baron, please?
Okay. I have a deep prejudice here that dates back several years. And this whole story sort of – it was broken by Charlie Savage, who won a Pulitzer Prize at the Boston Globe for his work on George Bush's signing statements. He went to the New York Times to cover the Department of Justice, and he broke the story that that Baron and Marty somebody, whose name escapes me, co-authored a memo at the Department of Justice.
Marty Lederman.
Thank you, of Georgetown University. Co-authored a memo for the notorious Office of Legal Counsel at the DOJ, and I'll get back to that in a second. Authorizing, it was exactly like, in my opinion, what was going on in the Bush administration, except this was the Obama administration. They were looking for a covering, you know, legal cover, so they could go kill this incredibly bad guy who has a complicated name, like Anwar al-Awlaki.
Yes.
An American
citizen.
Who was working with al-Qaeda.
Right. So they were – I mean, I am really cynical and dark, and I am obsessed about this. I was the first Globe writer ever to write about this when Julia Kayyem, Mrs. David Baron, was actually in the building. And believe me, I went to tremendous lengths to avoid speaking to her.
She's running for governor. We'll get to her in a minute for those who are not familiar
I speak solely from prejudice. I phoned both Baron and Marty. And they were very polite, and they refused to talk to me. But it was Charlie Savage's scoop. My deep-seated prejudice here is sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander. These Bush guys were unbelievable. From the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, the Bush-Cheney terror apparat, paid a high price, in my opinion, for writing memos like these. The notorious torture memo, for instance.
Yep.
Possibly written by John Yoo and possibly with a co-author, Goldsmith. In any case, I felt this was insane hypocrisy that John Yoo, whom I don't know personally, but I do know, literally had to go into hiding when he left the George Bush administration. He was at Whitman Law School, and I was in touch with him. Said, "I bet you're hiding there," and he denied it. But in fact, at Berkeley, he's actually fairly prestigious professor at Bolt Hall, which is University of California, Berkeley's law school. They were trying to strip him of his tenure.
So here's what Alex wrote, actually, in 2011. He wrote, "So if you is a war criminal, then please explain the status of Harvard Law School Professor David Baron and Georgetown University Law Professor Lederman." So your position was liberals were two-faced. They were hypocrites. While they were trashing you for the torture memo, they were not trashing, let's focus on Baron for the moment, for the drone memo. But you are aware, and by the way, that is what's holding up his nomination. It's not clear to me whether it's the issue of whether the Obama administration will release the drone memo to the public, would that be enough, or if it's the underlying thing. And obviously it's an odd mix of liberals and Rand Paul,
which is always interesting.
And the ACLU is deep into it.
But you should know, while the Civil Liberties Union, I assume, was one of your targets, as was public radio, by the way, in your column, in 2011, the Civil Liberties Union is opposing the nomination of Baron. Are you aware of that?
Of course I'm aware of it.
Okay, fine. So, I mean, they're not hypocritical here, are they? Liberals were upset with John Yoo, and the Civil Liberties Union is not happy with David Baron. Where's the hypocrisy?
My beef is basically with the media. The media has been silent, I would argue, up until now. I mean, I had a friend.
Well, also academia. If the University of Berkeley is trying to get rid of you, Harvard Law School not?
Baron is like a god over at Harvard Law School. He did a huge project for Drew Faust, blah, blah, blah. I bet he's a good guy. I mean, let's not get into the holes in my argument, because I mean, seriously, because that would be,
we only have a 2-hour show.
That would ruin it, yeah, I guess. Yeah,
but wait, I'm not sure I'm entirely finished raving on this subject.
Oh, sure.
I mean, as I pointed out in that column, you know, I'm in a complicated position because I approve of killing bad guys. I always have. I thought Bush and Cheney were on the right track. Kill the bad guys. Torture them. I don't have a problem with that. But I really, it disgusts me. Jane Mayer is like a friend of mine. Jane Mayer got rich, you know, accusing Cheney and his dark shadow wedding, Eddington, whatever his name is, you know, of all this malfeasance. They tortured people in Poland, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. I'm just saying, New Yorker, where's your big takeout on David Barron? Where's your big takeout on renditions under the Obama administration? I really do feel strongly about this. I think this is two-faced media hypocrisy BS.
Okay, I think we have heard a lot of media discussion, though, of the drone strikes in general. I mean, there's been a lot of opposition to that. And I think some people would see that
differently. He doesn't want you to spend time putting holes in his argument. But go ahead, Marjorie.
I think it's not unreasonable to see a drone strike which kills somebody, let's hope, outright with waterboarding. I think some people would see that differently.
They might.
Opposed to torture.
Yes.
Well, I don't really have a problem with drone strikes, although I feel that what
on American citizens, even if it turns out they're allied
with the
enemy?
I feel that's what people haven't debated about the Barron Marty memo, is this notion that you can kill an American citizen. I mean, that's a super big deal. That should go by the Supreme Court at the very least.
I presume, where are you on this with Juliette Kyan, who's running for governor?
I've never met her.
Okay, but you're not casting any aspersions on her
candidacy? Not at all. In fact, you know, she was a Pulitzer finalist as a Globe. Globe column. Surprisingly, she didn't write about this issue, eyeball roll. But
I mentioned David Bernstein, who's our colleague here, wrote a piece in Boston Magazine saying that while it is true Juliette Kyan has nothing to do with this, in light of the fact that her key credential is Homeland Security, on which she is seen by some liberals as a little too hawkish, that unfairly or otherwise she may be tarnished at the convention where she needs 15% in June by liberals, again, because their attitude is you visit the sin of the husband unfairly on the wife. You have no problem with that?
Well, no. I mean, I have no problem with what Bernstein wrote.
Oh,
no,
fine.
I disagree with that. I want to put a torpedo right. Amidship, my jive argument. The fact is, I mean, but and again, it kind of speaks to what irks me. Naturally, the Goldsmith torture memos were leaked immediately, essentially by the liberal DOJ apparat or somebody mm-hmm. who's in bed with the media. The big hole in my argument here is that we haven't seen the 60-page memo, the Barron memo. So
it's not a hole in your argument, because if it turns out there is nothing that should be troubling, then the Obama administration, for starters, should at least release it to members of the Senate. And secondly, as this guy Udall, a Democrat, has said, I don't want it delivered in the Senate secretly. I want it released to the public, or I am not voting in favor of Barron's nomination. That's
a
Democrat.
I still think, in what purports to be an intellectual argument, it's a big to discuss something that you don't know what it is. I mean, you know, maybe they said it's a really bad idea to kill this American citizen and we're changing the Constitution in a bad way.
Well, there's a hole in the argument that I'm really fascinated by, and I want to know, when Juliette Kyan was a columnist at the Boston Globe, you, of course, were a columnist at the Boston Globe, when you had to walk by her desk, I mean, did you go backwards down Morrissey Boulevard? Did you go to the parking lot to avoid her? How did you handle those?
I never introduced myself. I heard
so
all...
So you hope she'd not know who you are.
Well, right. Also, my column was buried in the back of the Jeep section.
Okay.
I mean, I assume no
you know
one
what the
read
beauty
it.
Is, compare two Globe columnists, even though he doesn't work for the Globe, apparently. Right. Alex Beam, mm-hmm. who hides out from Juliette Kyan when he criticizes her and her husband, Dan Shaughnessy trashes players. And what does he do the next day? He goes right back in the locker room and confronts the players. What's the matter with you?
He's a man's man.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Can we talk about, speaking of the New York Times, here's the line.
I have an even stupider. I was actually at a party with them.
Yeah.
And I asked
with Kyan and Barron? And what happened?
I asked my wife, I said, do you think David Barron has a sense of humor? Could I go up and tap him on the shoulder and said, I'd prefer you were in jail rather than...
I think he'd love that.
My wife said, you know, Alex, I wouldn't really take that risk.
I think it's probably a good point.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote a piece in the New York Times, of all places, on April 29th. Now, the line that stuck with me is, for the record, I no longer work at the Globe. I know, technically...
It was a year ago.
Oh, whatever. So what? Oh, that was in
Duh.
Between.
Yes,
oh, okay, then
yes.
fine. Then
okay.
I take it back.
Good.
But your whole point, confessions of a word snob. I mean... For you, of all people, to write a piece trashing other famous authors for using words that mere mortals don't understand.
Whom did I talk about? Hypocrisy. Trash? What are you talking
about? Nabokov or something? Who did you?
Or
Nabokov,
as he sometimes.
Oh, is that how he's referred to? My apologies.
Yeah.
I gotta tell you,
I didn't trash him. I praised him.
I was unable to prepare for today's show because I had to spend an hour and a half looking up like 75 words.
Oh, stop!
I mean, fritillary.
Fritillary.
Fritillary. Yeah. Chamfrain. How do you?
I have no idea what any of those words.
Okay. Well, these are the.
What was your point in that piece, by the way? Was there a point there?
It was actually about my love for words. It was the thing at the end. I actually declared that there are some words I'm openly in love with. Also, it's all about my bizarre anger, repression, and vengeance. I wanted to fire this torpedo across Marty Baron, not David Baron. Marty
Your
Baron's
old boss.
Yeah, because he spiked my gyro ball column.
Explain what gyro ball is.
That really bleeped me off.
Okay, what is gyro ball?
It's definitely explained in this.
Most people don't have it in their hand.
It's a sort of pitch.
It's what
explain
Daisuke Matsuzaka. Yeah, I'll explain it, all right.
Yeah,
explain it. Fine. Daisuke Matsuzaka came to the Boston Red Sox with all this fanfare and hyperbole maybe around 2007, and a huge story trailing him from Japan was that he threw a gyro ball, and there's almost an equivalent in English, and I'm blanking on it. But it was this famous pitch that went everywhere. It's a little bit like the Ephus pitch. I think Bill Lee used to throw an Ephus pitch. But in any case, a wacky, wacky curveball. And Marty Baron, man, he's such a serious guy. The editor of the Boston Globe, he literally sent out a memo saying, no one in this paper, sports writer or anyone, can refer to the term gyro ball. And then he appended some scientific
To prove that it may not really exist? Was that his argument?
I don't know. I thought we're supposed to be having fun at the newspaper. I mean, the gyro ball, how could you not write about it? It had a life of its own. It wandered all over the strike zone.
Your boss said don't use that word, and then you proceeded to write an entire column about that word?
I'm sorry. Is there an issue there?
Okay. And by the way, he really suffered as a result of it, and he's now editor of the Washington Post.
Yeah. I bet gyro ball is also off the table.
The reason I mistakenly assumed your column for the New York Times was in 2014 rather than 2013 is it came on right around the time that is it the Washington Post, speaking of Marty Baron, is putting out an edict about words that one should not use when one works for the newspaper?
Their Outlook section actually has gotten a fair amount of sort of internet traction. They put that out over a year ago. They keep a running tab of dubious cliches that they'd prefer to keep.
Like what, for example?
And I've used them all.
Do you know any of them?
I've used them all.
Should we say what a few of them are?
Yes.
You're not supposed to use words like deep-pocketed.
Deep-pocketed.
That's the New York Times, by the way.
Oh, is that the New York Times?
Yeah.
Words like narrative,
rare
fussy. Window, watering hole. I hate watering hole.
I love watering hole.
I love watering hole,
I hate
too.
It. It's so overused.
Underscores. What's wrong with underscores? Yeah. I've used that a zillion times.
You know, I actually brought two examples from today's Boston Globe.
Oh, good.
There's a spasm of violence. That's arguably a pretty tired cliche. But even better, they have a picture of these really cool water bottles with really cool patterns, and they say each bottle has a unique pattern. Now, that should never have gotten past the copy desk.
Oh, each bottle has a unique pattern. That's
one
a
of
very
a kind.
Good one.
Yeah, unique should not be misused.
Unique is always misused. People say it all the time. It's one of my bugaboos. So unique.
Very unique.
Yeah, people misuse it all the time. You know where they misuse it? On television, people that are reading the news.
Yes, no, it's.
I make a column suggestion to you?
Yes.
Who's the guy who writes all those funny? Well, I don't think they're that funny, but funny kind of songs. Who once did a song that was 100% every word was a palindrome? What's that guy's name? Weird Al Yankovic. That's exactly who it is. He did a song where every single word was a palindrome.
Can you sing a verse?
You should know. You should write a column where every single word, other than I know you have to use the and that, where every single word is a word that has had a taboo visited on it by the Washington Post, the New York Times. What do you think of that idea? Is that
it's
excellent?
Not that bad. Although in that column, I did the whole first paragraph. That would be fine. A friend of mine named Steve Greenlee actually sort of wrote a column like that, where he had newspaper cliche after newspaper cliche.
Now you have
no one would notice, of course.
Here's the sentence, by the way, that he wrote. Just so you said, the 2013 column: the list provides a rare window into the little noticed world of the editorial zeitgeist of that iconic newspaper. This is Alex writing at the time. He says, yes, almost every phrase in that previous sentence appears on the Washington Post's no-fly list. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
Including no-fly list, I believe.
No-fly list. That's another one. That's right. These are the words that you say that you're in love with, and I'm glad the relationship has been good for you, Alex. You say jejun. Is that how you pronounce it?
I have no idea.
Refractory and nugatory.
Those are great words. Yeah. I found refractory in my book, by the way. I was reading from my book, and I had the word refractory, which I love. It's just a great word. It means something or other. I don't know. It means, anyway.
Nugatory?
Everyone thinks nugatory is like Shap of the Three Stooges giving noogie.
It's like a negative. It's like a no. Isn't it mean
inconsequential?
Like,
inconsequential. I looked it up.
I think it's a synonym with jejune. Virtual synonym.
Speaking of readings,
I
find it, I think it's great. And by the way, your book is terrific. I think American Crucifixion. But you don't seem like the kind of person who would be comfortable going to a bookstore, which I know you're doing, out on tour. And I know you do this. Doing a reading, answering questions. Are you? What is that like?
Why do
you
say that?
Well, I'm asking. Well,
I feel in my deepest soul that I actually live for that. That's the genuine vanity of writing. You have to ask yourself, in a way, you live to be able to stand in front of people.
Because that's your audience. You're saying essentially your audience coming to you. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I did a reading just. I like it. In fact, you've touched on another one of my bizarre obsessions.
What's that?
Authors who don't read at readings. I have a close friend. I'm not going to mention him on the air because. But he gives these readings.
David Baron. Go ahead.
He gives these readings, and he feels like he's like so famous. He goes like, "Well, I'm not going to be reading from my book. I'm just going to tell you about all my important friends and what they think." And that's a scandal. I'm going to give you a specific example. At Brookline Booksmith, for some reason,
they
went
great author readings.
I went downstairs. There's a guy named Jonathan Dee reading from his novel, D-E-E. The guy was such an amazing writer. I bought the book right there. However, just for your listeners, Jonathan Dee's Palladio is the novel they really should read. It's three novels back. This guy's a great writer. I mean, to me, it's all about, in fact, I think it's suspicious authors who don't read at readings. Give me a break. What do you mean? Maybe you can't write.
Why would you not tell us who this person is? Because now you've sort of whet everybody's appetite.
Probably one of his good friends. You know, it occurred to me that you have a thing going on with Marty Baron, former editor of The Globe, David Baron, Harvard Law School professor. I know they're spelled differently, but you think there could be a link there?
No.
Okay. No. Just checking.
Alex, speaking of columns, you wrote one this morning. What exactly was the point of this?
It's about to get paid, I think, was the point.
It's about luck. What was the point of this column exactly?
Wait a minute.
I got it. It's organizing your luck life.
Yeah, no, it came. Now I can use actual names. This was in the Globe cafeteria like 4 years ago. Larry Harmon is an editorial writer, came to me, and he said there was a big casino executive just talking to the executive editorial board of Boston Globe, and he offered this point, this interesting point that the Chinese, of course, are huge gamblers, they're in a lot of casinos, and apparently, if it was like this Dagwood moment, you know, if this guy, indeed, I was criticized for using a stereotype. Okay, fine, but as it was explained to me, if the Chinese man comes home and he's lost all the entire family fortune, his wife doesn't say, you know, doesn't hit him on the head with a rolling pin. She says, "Oh, bad luck management. You should have arranged the luck better." And then I go on and I actually steal from a piece my son wrote out of Beijing. My son wrote
That's
a
great.
Piece. Yeah, exactly.
No
one is safe. I know. I think there might be an exception.
I think there is. Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually mentioned that he did a piece about, interestingly, in China, URL addresses are often just numbers. And people's Twitter handles and stuff are often just numbers because they want to get
lucky numbers.
Yeah, they want to get four in there a lot. And it was in his piece actually that from which I stole that thing about the airline. Although he didn't do his research because I learned that this was a bad luck airline that had a hijacking in 2003. They changed their 800 number, if you will, to all eights, four eights,
ten eights, yeah.
And Sichuan Airlines, if you're feeling lucky, you may want to fly them. But in any case, they haven't had an incident of any kind since they got this new phone number.
Yeah, Alex,
if that's not dispositive, what is?
I think it is.
You mentioned in this column that you begin every month, year, decade, and millennium by reciting the words rabbit, rabbit.
I do. Is there anything strange about that? I also sent an email to my sons urging them to begin. But the key.
What is rabbit, rabbit, please?
I Googled it. I couldn't find an explanation. It's too super. My mom taught it to me. It's when you wake up the first day of every month, you should say rabbit, rabbit, and that will augur well.
Wait a second. You're looking at Alex Beam as if he is crazy for doing this. Marjorie, you told me about 10 years ago. If something happens, you go back in the house and you sit in the chair or something. What is that? I just realized. What is it you do again?
If I forget something, well, that's because my
just
mother did it,
us.
And
okay,
I feel
fine.
As though I have to keep
what
doing
is it?
it.
What is it?
Well, if I forget something, I go back in the house and get it, but before I leave, I have to sit down in a chair and bless myself.
What do you think of that?
I think that's great. I think that's absolutely great.
I mean, really.
The Russians, by the way, the Russians feel you should sit down, you know, before leaving the house.
Yeah, well, there you go.
But they don't
bless themselves. I
don't
think it's any weirder than rabbit, frankly. At least I know what it came from. Did your mother say rabbit?
No, my mother told me to say rabbit. And the key, of course, was the millennium. And I think I did say rabbit on the first day of the millennium.
Thank God.
All right, that time has come again. About 5 or 6 weeks ago, not for you to leave yet. Five or six weeks ago, we started these 45-second explainers where Alex takes a rather arcane topic and explains it. It attempts to explain it in 45 seconds or less. This one is not – well, actually, it's something that a lot of people have thought about. It's not quite as – I don't know what it is. You just listen. Here's the question, Alex, for you. How do you make money selling tacos or burritos for $4.75 or less? You ready for this?
I am ready for
this. Okay, so here's the deal. We set the clock. You can start in 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, I emailed your producer saying I wasn't actually prepared to do this explainer. But I feel once you're committed to radio, you've got to go for it.
Go ahead.
I did, quote unquote, reach out, a word which is on my personal
no-fly
list. Hate
that word.
Hate that word. I reached out to Adam Liebman, a friend of mine and a co-founder of The Wrap, which later became Boloco, which sells. I happen to like them because I used to have this guest card.
They have the mini ones, too. They're excellent. Love those.
They're unbelievable.
Go ahead.
He didn't get back to me, so I have to wing it. I did learn. There's several ways. And I'm going to end this with a dramatic.
You haven't started.
I'm going to end this with a philippic against the minimum wage law.
Okay,
wow.
Philippic.
Okay.
Philippic, indeed. But one way is you can always sort of upgrade. You can do organic tacos. You can claim that all this junk you put in them is organic. Blah 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 blah. But the other, I mean, the key, it's clear you can use the worst possible. You can lose like ground up dog meat and stuff.
Oh.
That's not a problem. However, it occurred to me that. Raising the your labor is practically your key economic factor in keeping taco costs down.
Yeah.
So if we raise the minimum wage, think of the disastrous.
The end of the $4.75 taco.
It's the Anna's Taqueria, Boca Grande. You can kiss them goodbye.
Okay, I do
fine.
Love
that
Anna's
was really,
Taqueria.
That was excellent.
Okay,
thank
Alex,
you so much.
I really have no idea.
Keep the minimum wage down. That's the basic message there.
Keep the working man down.
It's pro-torture, too.
Exactly.
So.
Oh, okay. My God. Where does it
Alex
stop?
Alex Beam is a columnist for the Boston Globe. His new book, American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex, so great to see you.
By the way, do you know where you're going to be? What media outlet you'll be appearing on at 6 o'clock tonight?
I'm going to be in a nationally recognized television show.
What would that be?
It's called Broadside. It's on NECN. It has unbelievable penetration.
Broadside, the news
all over
Jim
the
Rowdy with Alex Beam.
This is a huge show, by the way.
Oh, my God. We'll all be tuning in.
We're going to move some units.
We're looking.
Thanks, Alex, for being here. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Emily's List and our Friday news quiz with two beer aficionados challenging each other over the week's news. To hear our podcast, or to read more on what we talked about today, go to our website, wgbhnews.org/BPR. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.